You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Pardon the interruption. We'll bring you back to your podcast in just a moment. But first, promo for the Cosmic Pizza Podcast.
Here on the ESO Network, three hosts recommend this podcast.
I recommend it.
I recommend it.
And I recommend it.
On the Cosmic Pizza Podcast, it's a slice of life as we discuss literally anything in the universe. Cosmic Pizza Podcast.
Here to serve all of your needs.
Wednesday, I'm here with you people. It's, like, wild.
No pizzas were harmed in the creation of this podcast.
This is full-scale war against the terrible enemy that modern man has never fought.
Evidently, you do not realize you are in an interstellar conveyance. You are already outside the atmosphere of your own planet.
Monster attack! Monster attack! Monster attack! Monster attack!
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. We're going back to 1941 and one of our favorite horror film actors that we've talked about here on Monster Attack over the years, Bela Lugosi. And this is a film that has been requested by several of you guys out there, and we decided it was time to get it out and do a show on it. It's one that sort of, I don't know, we just sort of put it off for quite a long time, but I don't know why. It's an odd little potboiler, but it's a great film that showcases some of the talents of Bela Lugosi. So I will say right out of the blocks that if you're a fan of Bela, you're probably going to like this film. As a kid, I liked it, and I'm not really sure why I liked it. I think I just enjoyed it because I was such a big fan of Bela Lugosi. The storyline has some problems, but it's still a very entertaining film to watch. I've watched it a couple of times now in the last week and still find it quite engaging. The name of the film is The Invisible Ghost. Actually, drop the "the." That was one of the working titles, but it's been released over the years as just Invisible Ghost. Now, it doesn't involve any invisibility, but I can see where the ghost comes from. And as we get into the storyline, we'll talk a little bit more about how it became that. Bela, to go back to a little bit of history on this, developed quite a good rapport with Sam Katzman. And of course, we've talked about Sam Katzman quite a bit, known for producing a lot of low-budget sci-fi and horror films. Katzman films, he was sort of like the Roger Corman of his day because his movies made an awful lot of money. In fact, probably a lot more money than people would have expected them to make. He did, at this time of when this film was being made, he was working with Monogram Pictures, which was considered a quote-unquote budget studio. Critics called it more like Poverty Row. There was a series of studios that made nothing but B-pictures like serials and horror films and cheap westerns and things like that. And they would refer to them as Poverty Row Pictures. Monogram was one of the bigger studios with that moniker. But during this time, Katzman produced a number of films with the East Side Kids, sort of a poor man's Bowery Boys. And he signed Bela to star in a couple of those, as well as eight other films. Now, Bela would make nine films altogether with Sam Katzman. And this would be the first film in a series of nine films that Bela would do with Sam Katzman, operating under the production company Banner Productions. So we've got an interesting little film going here. I'm struggling a little bit as to actually describe it. It is a horror film, but it's almost more of a murder mystery. And the one thing that I liked about this, and I think what appealed to me a little bit as a kid, was that the storyline did get into some deeper issues that we weren't accustomed to seeing from low-budget films in the 1940s. A lot of psychological issues. So first I want to introduce you to the people that you're going to meet in this film. It is written by Al Martin. Al Martin wrote a ton of screenplays in a lot of low-budget films over the years. One of my favorites that he wrote In fact, one of my favorite monster movies growing up as a kid, Invasion of the Saucer Men. Really an awful little film, but just one that, you know, guilty pleasure, I guess, that I loved over the years. It was one of those films that every time it came on, I had to watch it. He writes a pretty good little script here, but it's been criticized over the years. And of course, it received some mixed reviews from the critics initially in 1941 when this was released, because there's parts of it that just don't make any sense. But that's in perspective. It didn't make any sense compared to movies that were being made. There's some elements about the storyline that I really like. And as I got older, it became even more interesting to me. Even though if you just look at it on its surface, the story is a little ludicrous, but we'll get into that as we get into the storyline. Let's talk about the people that you're going to meet here. Of course, Bela Lugosi, 10 years before this, it made his big mark with Dracula. And then, of course, by this time he had appeared in Son of Frankenstein, which I think was one of his best films. Also The Black Cat and others. You know, and Bela is the kind of guy that was misunderstood over the years. And, you know, when the word got out, you know, in the 50s and stuff, you know, he was pegged as a junkie and all that. And we saw some of that in the film Ed Wood, which, you know, that was the only thing that upset me a little bit about that film, was that when you really get into reading about Bela Lugosi and his career, the one thing that is a standard of what people who worked with Bela said over the years was he was a consummate professional. He always came prepared to the set. He always worked well with his fellow actors, and was just one of the best to work with. Yes, he was addicted to opiates because of a back condition that he had, and a doctor had prescribed him painkillers for this back condition that he had. And like many people back then, and even today with the opiate problems that we have today, he became hopelessly addicted to them and had to seek rehab, and was in rehab and was able to get clean and sober not too long before he died. But it did take a toll on his career. And it was really a bad knock that he had. Of course, you know, we talked about the bad knock he took for doing Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, playing the Frankenstein monster, the only time he would play the Frankenstein monster, with people not realizing that the character is supposed to be blind. So, you know, he's taken bad raps over the years on that. But Bela is just one of my all-time favorite horror film actors. And he was one of the first big ones that I saw as a kid, and just remained a favorite, even during his Ed Wood days. And even some of the raps he took during those days were really unjustified. And Ed Wood took some bad raps from that. They said, oh, you know, he exploited this washed-up actor and all that. But if you read a lot of the books that were written about Bela and Ed Wood in that whole time period in the 50s, when you know, Bela's health was starting to fail him, he and Ed Wood were very good friends. Ed was such a fan. He was a huge fan. And just it meant the world to him to be able to work with Bela. There was no exploitation there at all. This was a guy that just wanted to see this actor get back on top again. So that, you know, just trying to knock down some of the rumors and some of the misinformation that's come out over the years. I think Bela will still, 50 years from now, be considered one of the top horror film actors of all time. So that attracted me as a kid to this movie. I think I was probably about 10 years old when I first saw Invisible Ghost. It didn't get a lot of airplay on the monster movie circuit, probably because it was a little different than some of those. But there were a lot of horror films that came out during this time period that were more like murder mysteries or crime mysteries than they were horror films. So, you know, again, we were dealing with a situation where, you know, when the quote unquote term monster movie came out, it encapsulated a lot of films. Is the film scary? Not really, but it's got some scary moments. It's got some nice, nice bits. It was directed by Joseph H. Lewis, a very prolific director. Again, a lot of low-budget films. He did a lot of serials, westerns, a few horror films here and there. But he wasn't really known for horror. But you know, he was a very competent director. And again, this film gets a little bit of a knock of having a storyline that's a little crazy. Well, let's see. I want to introduce you to the people first that you're going to see. Because some of these names you're not going to recognize. Some of the people you might recognize in here, but there's some real interesting, this is a real interesting a collaboration of actors that they put together for this film. So I if Lewis made the final choices on these actors, then he's done a good job of putting together a pretty good cast that has a great chemistry. Our female lead is an actress by the name of Polly Ann Young. And Polly was a very successful actress as a child. She started at a very, very early age. And this would be actually her last film. She would get out of the business right after this movie, would get married and concentrate on raising a family, as many, many actors did back then that started at an early age. She was born in Denver, and one interesting thing about Polly Ann Young is she is the sister of Loretta Young and Sally Blaine. Now, Loretta Young probably was the most successful out of the three of them, but she was featured in more than 40 films. And, you know, a lot of the films that she made, she didn't get credit for, you know, the uncredited roles, small roles, but she had a nice prolific career from 1917 to 1941. And then it was time to get out of the business. So, you know, again, like a lot of actors during this time that started at a very, very early age, she got out of the business at an age where she could raise a family. She ended up marrying Carter Herman in 1936. They had four children. And, of course, you see they were about 5 years in their marriage when she decided to get out of the business and concentrate on her family. She remained married to Herman until he died in 1981 of cancer. So she lived a very long life. She was 88 years old, passed away in 1997. And she plays Bela Lugosi's daughter and will have a key role in some of the weirdness that's going to be going on. Let's go on real quickly. I'm going to just give a quick rundown on some of these people. We've got John McGuire, who is probably going to be a guy that you recognize. He was very, very big in a 20-year period from the 30s to the 50s. He played a leading man early on in his career. Very, very attractive guy, you know, big strapping type guy. He appeared in a couple of the Charlie Chan movies, some serials, westerns and things of that nature, and had a very, very good career. In this film, he plays two characters. He plays Ralph Dixon, who is the fiancé for Polly Ann Young's character, Virginia Kessler. And then he also plays his character's brother, almost like a twin brother. So this is going to figure very prominently into the story. Bela Lugosi's character, I should talk about him. He is Dr. Charles Kessler. He's a medical doctor. We find out that he's quite a big wig in the city that this takes place in. We really don't know, you know, where. I'm assuming it's a small city in California, but it's never really said. Lives in a, you know, very big house. Has, you know, he's very well off, has a lot of money. And again, he garners a lot of respect from the people in the town. And we find out that a very strange murder occurred at his home when his chauffeur was mysteriously strangled. And it's a murder that when this movie opens up is still gone unsolved. Okay, we're going to get more back to that after we get into the cast list here. One of the more interesting guys that I think that's in this film is a fellow by the name of Clarence Muse. Clarence plays the butler. He is the only black actor in the film. I think his life is almost more interesting than some of the parts that he played. He didn't originally start out as an actor. He wanted to be a lawyer. And he actually ended up going to law school for 1 year, but left in 1908 because he didn't feel like he could make a living in the field of law as an African-American. He did receive an honorary doctorate of law's degree from Dickinson School of Law in 1978, but he started acting in the 1920s, and then he got very, very active in a couple of the big theaters in Harlem and became really sort of a proponent for equal rights for African-American performers. And most of his life he spent championing for better roles for African-Americans and, better parts because, at this time period, and even when this film was made, blacks didn't get really good. They were very stereotypical type roles. Now, it's interesting that I say that because he's playing a butler in this, although the character that he plays in this is a very, very interesting character. It's a character that derives a lot of respect from Dr. Kessler. He's been with the family for many, many years. And it's not your typical stereotypical, type black butler. He's very well spoken and he's very devoted to the doctor. Now, some of the other people that you're going to see in this film are Terry Walker, who was an American actress. She has a very small role in this, and she didn't do many movies. Mainly was a female lead in a lot of Western B pictures. Very pretty gal. She actually, her real name was Teresa Norberg, but she performed under Terry Walker. And she plays sort of a maid, does the cooking and cleaning and stuff for Dr. Kessler. And she's one of our first victims in the film, and we'll get to that in just a second. Betty Compson plays probably the best female character in this other than Polly Ann Young's character. She plays the wife of Dr. Kessler, and we're led to believe in the beginning of this movie. Oh, by the way, spoiler alerts all the way around. If you've not seen this film, everything's going to get spoiled. Still an interesting film to watch, though, even with the spoilers. But just want to give you a chance to go hunt this down. Easy film to find and to watch. And it's a very quick watch. It's only an hour and 20 minutes long. Okay, but anyway, I needed to get that spoiler out because I'm going to give one away right now. We're led to believe that Mrs. Kessler might have been dead. We're not really sure. This is one of the more interesting characters in the movie and a central focus of the movie. We're going to tell you why in just a minute. But Betty Compson was a very, very successful actress. She was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Actress for a film called The Barker. And she just went on. She had a very, very prolific career, a long, long life. And she has one of the more interesting characters in this movie. Okay, again, folks, I'm struggling so much because it's so hard to describe this film. Ernie Adams, this is a guy you're going to recognize. He plays the gardener of the estate that Kessler lives on, old-time actor that did more stage work than film work and also was known for a lot of writing. He wrote some plays and a couple of scripts. So a very, very likable character. Almost thought that maybe he was a British actor, but I mean, because he's got that look about him, but he's not. He's all American and played very similar roles in most of the films that he was cast in. Atola Nesmith is another one that you're going to see a lot of on television and films. She actually worked as a horror host for a Los Angeles station, KTLA, for a while. This was back during the time of Thriller, when Boris Karloff was doing Thriller and, the Chiller Theater stuff. She made a couple of appearances actually on that show. But a fascinating gal, a long, long life and a very, very successful career, but was a real staple in the Los Angeles community in the acting field. And then we're going to talk about Fred Kelsey, who plays our detective. He's a guy that's very familiar. He's one of those guys like Dick Miller. You recognize the face. You might not know his name. Always plays a cop or authority figure of this type, maybe a judge or something like this. But he plays the detective that has been trying to solve the murder mystery of this of Kessler's mansion here. And of course, we're going to see a lot more murders in this. I mean, people just die right and left in this film. So let's get right to the crux of this movie. Like I said, this is a weird little film, but it was one that it just caught me as a kid. It was one that I really liked. One of those films that I don't really know why I liked it as a kid, but and as I got older, I became even more appreciative of what this film did. It's out there. And, you know, I always sort of prided myself on liking cult films and films that were a little crazy, you know, and it didn't follow normal conventions. So that may have been something that attracted me to this film as a kid. It opened up that chapter of my life where I got really heavy into cult films. Dr. Kessler, we find out when we meet him, he's looking at this big portrait of his wife. And we find out through a series of conversations, butler tells us a little bit of that when he's talking to some of the characters in this film, that he's having dinner with his so-called wife, who's not there. In other words, it's a long table. He's at one end. There's another place setting. There's something very sort of strange going on here. And we find out that Mrs. Kessler left him. He was totally devoted to her. She fell in love with someone else and left him suddenly. And then we get two different stories coming out of this. One that after she left him, she got into a serious automobile accident and died, or at least Kessler sort of treats it that way. But then again, also there's a side of Kessler that is always waiting for her to come back. And on their anniversary, on their wedding anniversary, and this is when the movie opens up, he always has this dinner with his wife. So we know something weird is going on here. Bela's character has been affected, you know, dramatically by the death of his wife. This is going to play heavily into what happens down the road here. Virginia is his daughter. She's engaged to be married to Ralph. And we meet him early on. And, of course, she's trying to keep some of this from him. We get the impression that she hasn't known Ralph not a long time. So she doesn't want him to know about some of the weirdness that's going on with her father. But he does find out, and he accepts it. And we find out, and I'm going to be passing over a lot of stuff very quickly here, folks. We find out that Ralph had a path crossing with Cecile, who is played by Terry Walker, she's our maid in this, and she's trying to blackmail him. You know, she went to work for Kessler because she wanted to be close to Ralph, and they have a little set to where she says Virginia can't have you, and if I can't have you, nobody can have you, and he sort of throws back at her by saying, I am not going to let you stand in the way of my happiness. I'm going to get married to Virginia, and that's all there is to it. Of course, Evans is parking the car after they've come back from a little drive. He and Virginia come back from a drive, and Evans overhears this argument, and that's going to play heavily into the storyline as well, because Cecile is found murdered the next morning. Now, we find out very quickly who's doing the murders, and that is Dr. Kessler. He is the guy. This is something that I found very intriguing about this film. You know the murderer right up front. This isn't one of your typical murder mysteries that would come out around 1940 or 1941, like The Sixth Victim and some of that, where you don't really know who is the guilty party. We know right up front that Charles Kessler is murdering all these people and probably murdered the chauffeur as well. But we see him murdering Cecile. And here's what sets it up. This is where the film gets really strange, because we have found out that Mrs. Kessler has not died. Not only has she not died, she's being kept hidden on the grounds by Jules, who's the gardener, because he sneaks food to her every night after dinner. There's this basement portion of this big garden barn that's on the premises. We don't find out how she became under the watchful eye of Jules. That's one part of the script that I wish they'd sort of explored a little bit, but it's not necessary. I just would have been interested in how that came about. But Jules is trying to get her. She has suffered a major brain trauma from the car accident. So all she knows is she wants to go home, but she's afraid to go home because she's afraid that her husband will kill her. And she says that. She says, you know, he will kill me. He will kill anybody. She's clearly not in a right mind. And Jules says on a number of occasions, in fact, when he meets with his wife, and she says, how long are you going to keep this up? You've got to tell him sooner or later that she's alive. He says, no, I'm going to wait until she gets better. I'm going to wait until she's better, and then I'll take her home. You know, and I don't think it'll be much longer. But what we find out is that Mrs. Kessler at night gets loose. She'll get out onto the property, and she will go up to one of the windows of the house and stare in the window. And Charles sees this. And we see this very early on. He's reading in his bedroom. And then all of a sudden, something comes over him where he's pulled to the window. And he looks out the window, and there she is. He sees her down there in the yard, standing next to a tree. And it clearly has an impact on him. Here's the wife that left him, that he sort of thinks is dead, but another side of him thinks she'll come back. And all of a sudden, it puts him into like a trance. I mean, he looks away, and then when he looks back out the window, she's gone. So this is where they sort of get the idea for ghost. She is sort of a ghost. She's not a ghost in the traditional sense. But it puts him in sort of a trance, and he starts walking around, and he ends up in the room of Cecile, takes off his smoking jacket, throws it over her head, and strangles her. Now, we don't see the actual strangulation. The actual couple of murders that we see in this are done through shadows and lighting, and this is from the point of view of Cecile. So these are nice touches in the film that I really like. So she's found murdered, and of course that introduces us to Detective Ryan, who's now, this is the second murder they've had here, very similar. And as they are investigating, Evans says, you know, he heard this argument between Cecile and Ralph. And this ends up resulting in Ralph's arrest. And of course, Kessler is totally, totally behind Ralph, trying to get him the best lawyers and all that to clear him. He believes him. He doesn't believe he murdered Cecile. This is sort of the thing that really is sort of typical of films that were made in the 40s, crime dramas in the 40s. Murders usually resulted in a death penalty, and it didn't take long for the death penalty to be executed. It's not like today, where there's all the appeals and stuff. It could be 20 or 30 years before a death sentence is executed. Ralph is convicted of murder in the first degree, and he is sentenced to death. And next thing we know, Ralph has been executed. We assume it was in the electric chair. I mean, I think that was the execution of choice back then. Could have been the gas chamber, but all we see is we see Dr. Kessler in Virginia. They're back at home. It's late at night. He gets a phone call and says, yes, I understand. And he looks at Virginia and says, it's all over. So Ralph has lost his life. An innocent man has been killed over something that Dr. Kessler has done but doesn't realize he's done. This is one of those situations where it's not that Kessler knows he's murdering these people. He doesn't. Every time he sees Mrs. Kessler, he goes into this trance-like state. He doesn't remember any of it when he comes to. So we're introduced now to Paul Dixon. He shows up. He's a dead ringer for Ralph, which causes some problems for Charles and Virginia and for Evans at first, because they all think they're going crazy. And of course, he meets Detective Ryan, and he wants to help out any way he can. And little by little, Paul gets suspicious of Charles. He just realizes that something's not right here. Now we have a situation where Jules, the gardener, he ends up getting killed. We see that it's done with a shadow. It's really, really a nice effect. So Jules dies. And then little by little, you know, and of course, this is always preceded by Mrs. Kessler showing up at the window. One of the best shots, and one of my favorite scenes is this, is when Dr. Kessler is downstairs and he always says, I'm going to read a little bit, then go to bed. And that always seems to just before he sees sees his wife. It's raining. It's a thunderstorm. And it's just pouring rain. And he all of a sudden, he's drawn to the window down there. And he looks, and she's looking in the window, soaking wet. Betty Compson plays this character so beautifully. Again, the acting in this is great. Even though the storyline's a little screwy, the acting in this, I can't fault any of the actors in this. And the direction in this is, it's not really, some people might say, well, it's a little over the top compared to movies nowadays. Maybe, but I'll tell you what, folks, from most of the films that I remember seeing from this time period and crime dramas of this time, this really isn't over the top. The acting in this is quite good. And I think it's one of the reasons that we're so engaged in this movie to begin with. So Jules has died. And this leads us, this film goes in all kinds of directions that you never see coming. Kessler is called by the coroner. He says, I need to have you come down with a couple questions for you. This is right immediately after the murder. And he's down there talking to the coroner, and Jules' wife shows up. She wants to see him. She says, may I see him for the last time? And the coroner says, yeah, I guess that'll be all right. He's in the next room, and he shows her. We see the body in there covered, and then he leaves to give her some privacy. And we see her lift the sheet off of her husband's face. Then we cut back to where Kessler and the coroner are talking, and we hear this blood-curdling scream come from the next room. They run in, and she goes, he's alive! He's alive! And then Kessler looks down, and his eyes are blinking, and he's alive! Oh, my God, they thought he was dead. They're getting ready to do an autopsy, and the man is alive, and he's trying to say something. And Kessler goes, who murdered you? Did you recognize who murdered you? And he sort of shakes his head no and dies. I'll tell you what, as a kid, that really slapped me in the face. I mean, this whole idea of here's this guy that had been picked up as dead, And he's lying in the morgue, and then all of a sudden he's really alive. First time I'd really seen that in a movie. It was like, ooh, I just made my skin crawl. And it really catches you off guard. That's why I'm hoping that if you're listening to this podcast now, you have seen this movie, because it's quite an effective scene. Well, little by little, Dixon suspects Charles. They have another incident where he sees Charles wandering around at night. And then later that day, or the following morning, we see that the portrait of Mrs. Kessler has been vandalized. Dixon thinks that there's something going on here psychologically with Kessler. He gets Detective Ryan to agree to bring in a psychologist, but the trick is Kessler thinks it may be Evans. He thinks that maybe Evans is the guy that's murdering everybody. So they set it up where he's talking to Evans, and they're giving him a sanity test. Dixon's watching this very closely. And while this is going on, now since Jules has been killed, Mrs. Kessler doesn't have anyone to bring her food anymore. So she's been sneaking into the house and stealing food. And we sort of get that idea because the new cook, who we've just been introduced to, makes a comment to Evans about, she says, I don't know what's going on. She says, I'll put out food and then leave the room for a minute, come back, and it's gone. I feel like I'm losing my mind. And Evans says, don't worry, it's just this house. It's just sort of a crazy little house. But while this is going on, Detective Ryan has put a bunch of detectives on duty to guard the house now, because we've had these weird murders, now the vandalized a portrait. They're upstairs in Kessler's bedroom, interviewing Evans, the butler, with this psychologist. But while this is going on, Mrs. Kessler is sneaking into the house once again, and she's caught by the two detectives that are there guarding the house. They go, oh, okay, well, this is very unusual. She says, oh, this is mine, this is mine. She's got a big, a turkey leg or whatever. And they go, come on, we need to have you meet somebody. We're going to take you home now. Because she just talks about she wants to go home. And she settles down, and they bring her upstairs and walk in while they're still talking to Evans. Kessler sees her and immediately goes into this trance-like state. And Paul's like, that's it. That's it. And even Ryan realizes, he says, it's Kessler. And Kessler tries to kill, he tries to kill the detective. He tries to, you know, he goes on a rampage and they catch him. And then they bring him out of this trance, because they're fearful that he was going to go try to kill Virginia. He was heading in her direction towards her room. And Paul said, when Kessler comes to, he says, we know who the murderer is. And Kessler says, Evans? And he says, no, it's you. And as the film ends, we don't really know if Virginia and Paul are going to get together, but they have sort of developed a relationship during this time because, you know, Kessler had allowed Paul to stay there with them while they were trying to figure out the truth behind Ralph and whether he was the murderer or not. And obviously he wasn't, because more murders kept on happening. And the film ends with them walking, the police walking Kessler out of the house. And it's left with that. Like I said, folks, it's a crazy little film. Once the mystery is revealed, they end it, you know, cuts to the chase very, very quickly. But there is just something about this film that's very engaging. If you're a fan of Bela Lugosi, I think you're going to enjoy this film for that reason. It's so much fun to watch Bela on this. Sometimes it seems like he's a little over the top, but not really. I mean, I think, you know, he's got a difficult role to play here. And again, some of the criticism this film got, that the story didn't make sense or it was ludicrous or whatever. You know what? It's a movie. And I think as a kid, that's, it sort of helped that I watched this as a young kid. At this point, I was young enough where I didn't really care about whether the movie made sense or not. And then as I got older, I became to appreciate, you know, these sort of cult-like films and, you know, ones that didn't have to make sense. That became very appealing to me. These characters are all very engaging. You know, fascinated with Dr. Kessler. And the situation involving Ralph, you know, the quick execution. We all knew he was an innocent man. The thing with Jules the gardener, you know, being carried away as dead and then coming back, in the morgue, you know, to the shock of everybody there. These were things about the movie that were just, wow. I mean, just, and then the imagery and the atmosphere of this, made for a really good little film. So, you know, I don't really know why I like this film so much, but I like this film a lot. And I know a lot of you out there do too, because a lot of you have asked for this movie. So I hope I did it some justice, but this has been quite an odyssey with me with this movie. It's probably the reason why I saved it for so long. But Invisible Ghost from 1941, a true Bela Lugosi tour de force, and a fun film. A very, very fun film. If you haven't checked it out, even though I've spoiled it all, check it out. You'll really enjoy it. Hey, folks, we'll be back with you again next Monday with an all-new episode of Monster Attack. Thanks again, as we always say, for your support. We're having a blast on this 8th season. We got some more fun stuff coming your way. Have a great week, and we'll see you on Monday.
What you gonna do, brothers and sisters, when thousands of geeky fans descend on Atlanta for 5 days and nights of the grandest con of them all? You can prepare by training, eating your vitamins, saying your prayers, and checking out the Dragon Con Report each and every month leading up to the show. Watch or listen and let Dragon Con Mania run wild on you!
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.